connection about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And here, some more information has been given about the Personality of God that actually is described as the cause of all causes. So everything in this world has a cause. And therefore, the scientists, they're anxious to try and define the cause of everything. They try to define the cause of everything as being a big bang or some cosmic slime or some accident, some cosmic accident. But they cannot explain where the slime came from. Neither they can explain what caused the big bang. Neither they can explain what caused the cosmos. Not to speak of the fact that they cannot give any kind of satisfactory explanation to explain where personality came into it. They try to pass it off and laugh it off as something that happened by chance. But we have no experience of that. We always have experience that persons are always caused by other persons. This is something we see in our everyday lives. It's a very natural phenomenon that adults produce offspring. The persons are always caused by persons. So the Shastra declares that the original cause of all the other persons and all the other things, the cause of all causes, is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That just as from our from some person, we find some production is there of some solids come from that person, some liquids come from that person, some gases come from that person. So we see the Shastra declares, Krishna declares himself in the Bhagavad Gita that he is the cause of all the solids and liquids and gases of all the entire world. He says, Mata sarvam pravartate, everything emanates from me. So here Krishna is being described as the original cause of all causes. Not just of the inert objects, but also the original, he's the original person, the cause of all the other persons in all existence, which he also declares in Bhagavad Gita. He says, Aham Bija Pradapita. He says, I am the seed-giving father of all living entities, and that all species of life are made possible by birth in this material nature, which he declares is also his. He declares the material nature is his own inferior material nature, his separated material nature, but nevertheless it's his nature. So he's the mother and the father. So Krishna is the cause of the mother and he's the cause of the children. He is himself the original father of all existence. So this is why Krishna is described here as the cause of all causes. And then it goes on to say, the reservoir of all rasas or relationships. So people experience all kinds of different rasas in this world. We have a rasa which may at sometimes a relationship or a mellow or particular flavor of exchange with someone. Sometimes those exchanges may be pleasing or sometimes they may not be so pleasing. You may one day have a very nice relationship with your bank manager, and then when he pulls the plug, then you may no longer have a very nice relationship with your bank manager. Or similarly, the parents, the children, the friends, the enemies. And here these are described, the first of all, the five primary relationships, neutrality, which here right in the beginning Prabhupada translates as a passive adoration of Krishna. So this is neutrality. This is the threshold of devotional service, adoring Krishna, actually, in a passive way. And then progressing on to engage in servitorship, actively serving Krishna. And then we see friendship, parenthood, and conjugal love. And we also see seven indirect relationships with Krishna, described as comedy, compassion, fear, chivalry, ghastliness, wonder, and devastation. So these rasas, these relationships exist in this material world. Sometimes we're devastated by the things that people do to us or say to us or the way they behave with us. Sometimes we're struck with wonder at the way things are going on with other people. or other things. Sometimes we experience the ghastliness of this material world or some ghastly situation. Supposing you see your friend run over by a bus. This is a ghastly situation. Of course, if he's not such a good friend, you may think it's not such a bad thing. But anyway, the principle, it wouldn't be Jayantibai. Jayananda wouldn't be doing it because he's no longer driving buses. So anyway, but also a chivalrous relationship and a sporting kind of fighting mood in showing off one's prowess or dexterity in so many ways. This is encompassed in chivalry. Or there may be some fearful situation in this world. These are all different relationships we have in this material world. And also, sometimes there may be a mood of compassion. We find that every now and again when there's an appeal on television, we get the pictures of people's dreadfully suffering conditions, and the broadcasters try to invoke our compassion and get us to dig our hands in our pockets and try to help those people and feel sorry for them and feel well disposed towards them. And also there may be a very funny relationship. There can be comedy, there can be hasya rasa, where some situation, somebody does something or says something which makes us laugh. This is hasya rasa. This is a relationship of comedy. Or, for example, the kings, they used to have court jesters just to make them smile and laugh first thing in the morning. Krishna also, he had sometimes court jesters. Even in Dwarka, so many dancers and jesters and people would come in the morning when Krishna would come into the assembly house just to set a nice mood for the day's activities. And just as we see also people watch all these comedy programs on TV to try to give them a good laugh, even if it's only a canned laugh, and try to forget about the miseries of the world and the day and their lives. So anyway, these different relationships are there. And here we see also another further explanation of this situation of Krishna being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that he's the supreme attractive form. Because actually we become attracted by different things in this world. Naturally there's the attraction, the male form is attractive to the female form is attractive to the male. But the most attractive form of all, who can attract the hearts of everyone, is Krishna. He's the supreme attractive person. That name of Krishna means the all-attractive one. That means if someone is beautiful, How do we describe attractive? Who'd like to explain what are the different elements of something that's attractive or someone that's attractive?
Beauty.
Beauty, yes.
Personality.
Okay, well they're all attributes of personality. So in a personality, what are the six attributes of personality? We said beauty, yes. If someone's very beautiful, then we're attracted. And then?
Friendship.
Someone with good knowledge.
Someone who has good knowledge naturally makes someone very attractive, yes.
Wealthy,
yes. If someone's wealthy, everyone wants to get close to them and hopefully get a little bit rubbed off on them. You have all these big, nowadays it's very popular to have a big business guru, someone who can teach you who's fabulously wealthy and who's offering the secrets. He's actually making himself more wealthy by trying to teach other people how to become wealthy, and says, follow my secrets and you'll also become wealthy. Of course, in the meantime, you're paying him lots of money.
Somebody who's giving.
Yes, this is kind of a secondary feature, but the primary elements, as defined by Parasara Muni, are beauty, knowledge, and what did we say? Wealth and fame, yes. If someone's very famous, you see these TV shows nowadays, everybody wants a few minutes of fame. They want to get on Big Brother or whatever it may be and become famous and have the whole world watch them. So we've got beauty, knowledge, wealth, fame.
Strength.
Strength, yes. If they're very powerful. If someone's very powerful, you get this big guy who's pulling the Rath car, or you find that someone like Hiranyakashipu is very powerful. Just by his power, he was very attractive. He was subduing everyone, and everyone's worshipping Hiranyakashipu because he's so powerful. They're scared of him also. That's an element of power. But actually, because of the power, because of the strength, someone's very attractive. Someone just like Krishna, he's all attractive because he lifts Govardhan Hill on his little finger of his left hand, just on the fingernail, tip of his fingernail, for a whole week, without any effort. Yeah, this is someone who's very powerful, someone who's very strong. So, very strong, and finally?
Opulence?
Hmm?
Opulence?
Yeah, well these are all types of opulence, yes. So, there's one more.
Renunciation?
Renounce, yes. Yeah, someone who's very renounced, someone who's really detached, renounced of everything, someone who's giving, like you mentioned, Cliff, someone who is ready to give everything. Krishna gives everything. He's very renounced. He doesn't hold on to and say, no, it's mine. No, he's ready to give everything to everyone. And it also to give up everything. Just as we see the example, the classic example that Krishna, during the arena of the Rasa dance, when the gopis were dancing with Krishna, or that it was before the Rasa dance began, and they were strolling along the banks of the Jamuna, and the gopis started thinking themselves, they're the most special women in all the universe. And so Krishna, he doesn't like his devotees to be proud, and so he simply disappeared. He gave up their company. Like that. So Krishna is completely renounced. He's completely renounced. He's the reservoir of all these opulences. When someone has some opulence, they're attractive. So this is the description of Bhagavan. Bhagavan means one who possesses all opulences. So these opulences are defined by Parashara Muni as being six. Someone has some strength. Everyone has some strength. We can lift up a book. This is an exhibition of some strength. But to lift up a hill, or you know, lift up another person, or lift up a few bricks, these are little difficult things, depending on our level of strength. But someone who possesses all strength, that person is Krishna. Krishna is the reservoir, because actually everyone else derives their strength from Krishna's strength. Similarly, if someone is famous, actually no one's more famous than Krishna. And Krishna, if someone becomes famous in this world, Krishna is giving them a little of his fame, potency, in fact, and some wealth. Krishna owns everything. We were discussing how everything's coming from Krishna. Actually, therefore, everything belongs to him. We see the simple example that the solids and liquids and gases that come from our body, we own. You know, people give us accusing looks. What is that? You say, it's yours. But the idea is that those things that come from our body, they're our own. But the things we may make in a factory, they don't belong to us. They belong to the owner of the factory. If you're making a Rolls Royce in the factory, does that mean that the Rolls Royce belongs to you?
It's like a film star. You have film stars, but they don't always stay film stars. That's where Krishna, there's always Krishna. If you see what I mean. I'm basically talking about false identities or not permanent.
Yes, Krishna's personality is all these wonderful qualities, because the movie stars, after all, they're sometimes a little beauty. Sometimes they're celebrated for their very ugly and horrible features. They get the nasty roles. But actually Krishna, he plays all the best roles, and if there's some demon to play a role, then sometimes Krishna will fight with demons, and sometimes Krishna will select his devotees to play the bad guys also. But the fact is that all the beauty, all the fame, all the knowledge, Krishna has all knowledge. He's the reservoir of all these opulences. If someone has some knowledge, Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, Vedaischa sarve ahameva vedya. By all the Vedas, I am what is to be known. I am the compiler of Vedanta, and I know the Veda as it is. Actually, all knowledge, Veda means knowledge. So Krishna has all knowledge. So if we have a little knowledge, he explains, he gives that to us from within the heart. Mata smriti jnanam apohanam cha. He says, I, dwelling within the heart, give them knowledge. I give them remembrance, forgetfulness, and knowledge. That comes from Krishna. So Krishna is the reservoir of all these qualities. He has all beauty. He's the reservoir of all fame, all power, all wealth, all renunciation, and all beauty. All these things, all these opulences. So this is the meaning of Bhagavan. So sometimes people are addressed in this world as Bhagavan. They may have some opulence in some way. They may be some way powerful. But actually real Bhagavan can only be applied to Krishna. Actually, this is the fact. So, and Krishna means, therefore, the all-attractive person. He possesses all opulences in full. So then when we discuss these things, he is the supreme attractive form, and by his universal and transcendental attractive features, he has captivated all the gopis. So here the description of Krishna is coming in, that in the supreme abode, in all existence, in Goloka Vrindavan, we find there are these wonderful transcendental forms of the maidservants of Krishna, who cannot be attracted by anyone else except Krishna. So here we see Taraka, Palika, Shama, Lalita, and ultimately Srimati Radharani. And Krishna has captivated them, actually. They are the topmost personalities in Goloka Vrindavan. So Krishna has captivated their hearts, and completely, their hearts are totally sold to Krishna. They can't go anywhere. So also, the request is here, because this is invoking the auspicious mood to explain what is the position of the Nectar of Devotion. What is this book about? This is what this introduction is about. And the request is here, the prayer is there, let His Lordship's grace be on us, so that there may not be any hindrance in the execution of this duty of writing the Nectar of Devotion. So this is Prabhupada's prayer, and he's explaining why he's doing it. Impelled, in other words, the force behind it is His Divine Grace, Sri Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada. This is Prabhupada's spiritual master. So if we want to do something auspicious, we have to do something under the guidance, under the order, with the blessings of the spiritual master, and that will make everything successful. So this is why Srila Prabhupada gave this book, because in fact Prabhupada explained that this Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, this is an English translation of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which Prabhupada presented as the Nectar of Devotion. Originally that Bhakti Rasamrita is in Sanskrit, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj, he instructed Prabhupada specifically, you read this book. This will be a very good book for you to read. Please study this book. So Prabhupada, taking that instruction, he also presented this book for us to read, but in the English language, so that we can make good sense of it and be able to understand its message, because Sanskrit would be very difficult, because it may take you 12 years just to get the hang of the Sanskrit language. So therefore we're getting it in our mother tongue, or what is not necessarily a mother tongue, but in a tongue, hopefully, which we can all relate to and understand. Any questions or comments so far? If there are any ideas which are a little foreign or strange, you know, don't worry, we can discuss and try and make it easy to understand. Okay, so Jayananda Prabhu, would you like to read us the next paragraph, please? We're on page XIX, just on the first page of the introduction.
Second paragraph now, please. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of Srila Rupa Goswami Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada, by whose inspiration I have been engaged in the matter of compiling this summary study of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. This is the sublime science of devotional service as propounded by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who appeared 500 years ago in West Bengal, India, to propagate the movement of Krishna consciousness. Sri Rupa Goswami begins his great book by offering his respectful obeisances unto Sri Sanatana Goswami, who is the elder brother and spiritual master, and he prays that Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu may be very pleasing to him. He further prays that by residing in that ocean of nectar, Sri Sanatana Goswami may always feel transcendental pleasure in the service of Radha and Krishna.
Hmm. So this is very important. Just like we take this point that offering respectful obeisances, Prabhupada, he's giving us this introduction before trying to translate this book and present this book to us. He's first of all offering his obeisances to the original author of the book, Srila Rupa Goswami, who's, just as we see here on the altar on the right-hand side, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. These were the six principal disciples of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And they were personally instructed by Lord Chaitanya in the science of devotional service. Srila Rupa Goswami and Srila Sanatana Goswami particularly were instructed directly by Lord Chaitanya. So Lord Chaitanya, if we understand him as being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this is not somebody's opinion. This is actually the statement, just like you can see on the wall outside, if it's still there, so many Vedic evidences from the Shastra. By no means complete reference, but a selection of some of the references in the Vedas which confirm the authenticity of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as being the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's not that we're just taking some guy's opinion, oh well, he's God. No, it must be authorized. So there are some nice references there to peruse and see how the Shastras declare that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Shastras are taken as Vedic evidence, actually. We have to have evidence. Just as if you go to court and you want to establish some legal point, there must be some legal precedent for such and such a case. And for those you refer to the law books. So the Vedas are considered the law books. They're the authoritative statements given by Vedavyasadeva to enable the human beings to understand what is to be done and what is not to be done. And so there must be some kind of evidence. There must be the evidence of what is there in the law book to establish this is how this is done in such and such a case, this person versus that person. If any of you have been to court, you'll know that this is how it works. And because there may be also evidence that may be unacceptable. Because, for example, if you've ever watched any of those courtroom dramas, you see that somebody presents some argument and the opposition objects and say, oh, this is hearsay. You know, this is just, you know, I heard somebody say this. That's not evidence. That's not accepted as evidence. That's thrown out of court. So the judge may say, strike that from the record. That objection is sustained, yes? Because it's useless evidence. But actual evidence, we accept the version which comes from the Vedic literatures. And the Vedic literatures means, factually, that which is given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because anything which... Krishna, just as Krishna is explaining, Vedaischa sarva ahameva vedya. He says, I am the compiler of the Veda and the Vedanta. So that actually scripture begins with God. Because nobody can make up the principles of religion. Only God can give the principles of religion. This is also confirmed in the Vedas. Dharmam hi sakshat bhagavat pranitam. That the codes of religion are directly spoken by God. What he speaks, that's religion. Just as if you have a king, then what he says goes. If there is a king in the state, then the principle is that the king, he's the ultimate authority. And if he says off with his head goes off. That's how it works. He's the ultimate authority because ultimately the king was the representative of God. He's the representative of the Supreme Lord, and his is the supreme authority. So nowadays, of course, they don't accept kings because they all became very degraded in the course of time. So now they have a democracy. So now if there's some legal wrangle, they go to the Supreme Court, if there's some legal challenge, yes? And the Supreme Court are the ones who decide. But actually, in the Vedic system, the Supreme Court is the king himself. And ultimately, he's representing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So what is spoken by the Supreme Lord, just like we read in Srimad Bhagavatam, so many things spoken by the Supreme Lord, and we read in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's expressing, when he says, this is my opinion, in Bhagavad Gita, this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead expressing his opinion, therefore it's accepted as truth and fact, and the ultimate guiding principle. When Krishna says, the principle of religion is sarva dharman parichajya mam ekam sharanam vraja. This is the religious principle. Actually, this is the supreme religious principle. This is the supreme dharma, to reject all other varieties of dharma in favor of surrendering to the Supreme Lord himself. This is the supreme principle of religion. So that which is spoken by God. So when we see these books, these are informations which are passed on by Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami as they heard them directly from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Therefore, in this movement, we're also known as Rupanugas, those following in the line of Rupa Goswami, actually, because he was instructed personally. And his elder brother, Sanatana Goswami, he's presenting this book in order to please his elder brother, present some delightful offering which will be satisfying to Srila Sanatana Goswami. For his sense gratification? No. Because Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, they're on the topmost level of Paramahamsa. So what will please them is the science of Krishna being explained very nicely. This is actually what Lord Chaitanya asked them to do. This is why he explained the science of Krishna to them in great detail for so many days, so that they could also present wonderful literatures, of which this is one, but a very, very important one for us to understand. There are others like Nectar of Instruction, that is the Upadeshamrita, and Srila Sanatana Goswami's book Hari Bhakti Vilas, which we will get in due course. But the teachings of Lord Chaitanya are a combination of the teachings, essentially, of the teachings to Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami. And that's a summary study of the wonderful book, the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is not a small book. It's actually presented behind Pravin Prabhu in those golden colored books behind, 17 volumes of the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, compiled by one of the other Goswamis, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, who studied the notes of Swarup Damodar Goswami and Murari Gupta, and he compiled this book when he was 90 years old, to present these very wonderful literatures. So these are all extraordinary works, in fact. Not just extraordinary because of the physical qualifications of the people who did them, but they're extraordinary because they present a first-class biographical account of the activities and the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So this book, as we'll see, Rupa Goswami's Nectar of Devotion, is so important because, as we read in the invocation, that the person who is presenting this song, Srinivasacharya, he's saying, Nana Shastra Vichara Naika Nipano Saddharma Samstapako. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the six Goswamis who are very expert in scrutinizingly studying all the revealed scriptures. So they're not simply making statements, but they're backing up all their statements with evidence from the Vedic literatures, actually. This is the fact. Everywhere, this whole book is backed up, all the statements, all the guiding principles are backed up by a scrutinizingly careful study of all the Vedic literatures to establish the eternal religious principles for the benefit of all human beings. So this is the principle. And therefore they're not presented lightly. They're presented with great scholarly acumen, great valuable research, and they're presented by topmost devotees of the Lord who are qualified to present the science of Krishna. So in this way, we see that the proper qualification, first of all, if one is going to attempt such a literature, one has to take the permission of the spiritual master, one has to get the blessings of the spiritual master and the Vaishnavas in order to undertake such a work. So here, we see, let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the lotus feet of Srila Rupa Goswami Prabhupada, who is the original author of this book, and of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada, by whose inspiration I've been engaged in the matter of compiling this summary study of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So this is not each and every single verse, but this is a summary study to give us the gist of this book, to help us understand the science of Krishna. Compiling the summary study of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, this is the sublime science of devotional service, as propounded by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who appeared 500 years ago in West Bengal, India, to propagate the movement of Krishna consciousness. This is Lord Chaitanya's movement. Lord Chaitanya wanted this movement of Krishna consciousness to flood the whole world with love of Krishna. That is the purpose of this Krishna consciousness movement. It is very nice that everyone has come and carefully studying and trying to understand this book, and having understood it, the principle should be, let us understand the mood of Lord Chaitanya who has given us this science and try to spread Krishna consciousness everywhere throughout the world. So this is actually this Krishna consciousness movement. Any questions or comments so far? Mukesh Prabhu.
I'd just like to ask, when it says the expert scrutinizer studied all the field scriptures.
Yes.
Vedyas, he's presented us with the
Vedas.
The Vedas.
Yes.
The different modes of nature, tamagun mode, the rajagun and the sattvagun.
Hare Krishna, Gary.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you for staying so long. Okay. Hare Krishna. Carry on. You were saying that he's presented these different literatures.
And obviously he was despondent when Narada Muni approached him. He wasn't satisfied. Obviously that, you know, he's presented all these scriptures and he's not so satisfied. So therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam was compiled. So, you know, when they say expertly studying all the revealed scriptures, where are they getting the eternal religious principles from?
Okay. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that the Vedas deal mainly with the three modes of material nature. But in there are some eternal religious principles also. But mainly they're dealing with the three modes of material nature, goodness, passion and ignorance, to try to dangle the carrot in front of people's noses that if you perform this religious activity, you'll get this benefit. So for people in the mode of ignorance, to try to elevate them gradually to the mode of passion. And for people in the mode of passion, to dangle the carrot in front of them so that they're gradually, by performing sacrifices and charity and little bit of austerity, they'll become gradually elevated to the mode of goodness. And people in the mode of goodness, to perform the religious principles by dangling the carrot, you'll go to the higher planets, you'll get a wonderful life in Svargaloka and so many different things. So the Vedas prescribe so many different carrots in the name of religion. And this is why Narada Muni told his disciple Vyasadeva that actually what you've done is somewhat condemned, my dear Prabhu. Because what you've done is you've encouraged people to enjoy. They've adopted the enjoying spirit, that I'm going to do this religious practice for my benefit, but in the name of religion. And for this reason, Narada Muni condemned his work. But he said, but actually your work will be complete now if you describe the name and fame and form and qualities and pastimes of the unlimited Supreme Lord. And specifically, my dear Vyasadeva, you were correct in your spotting the reason why you're feeling incomplete is because, yes, you have failed to specifically point out pure devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the Vedas do give information about that dotted here and there, but it's not at all clear because it's mixed up with all this other stuff about how to perform this religious principle, how to do this ritualistic process, how to do this type of sacrifice, and this and that, and these are the benefits. And therefore Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that people become, men of small intelligence become attracted by the flowery words of the Vedas, which present, oh, so attractive, beautiful prospects of how I will improve my life in the prison house of this material world. But the real principle, Krishna says, when your mind is no longer disturbed by the flowery words of the Vedas and your intelligence has passed through this dense forest of delusion, then you'll be indifferent to all that's been heard and all that is yet to be heard. And actually your mind will become fixed on me. So what happens is that the six Goswamis, they studied all the Vedic literatures and they quote from so many different Puranas and so many different Shastras, and especially from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because the Srimad Bhagavatam is, as it is described by Vyasadeva himself, the spotless Purana. Because it doesn't promote any other cheating religion. In fact, from the very beginning of Bhagavatam, the second verse, Dharma Projita Kaitavatra, completely rejecting, kicking out all religious activities which are materially motivated. This Bhagavat Purana propounds the highest truth, which is understandable by those devotees who are completely pure in heart. They've got nothing, no other material benefit to try to aspire for, to try to reach, to try to gain. The highest truth, this verse goes on to explain, is reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. What is the benefit? Tapotrayan mulanam, that this truth uproots the threefold miseries of material existence. So it also goes on to say, Srimad Bhagavate Mahamuni Krite Kimva Paraya Rishvara Sadyo Hridya Varudyate Yatra Kriti Bishu Shushubi Stakshanat. This beautiful Bhagavatam, compiled by the great sage Vyasadeva in his maturity, is sufficient in itself for God realization. And as soon as one attentively and submissively hears the message of Bhagavatam, the result, he becomes attached to the Supreme Lord. So this is the standard of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's specifically meant to establish the supreme status of pure devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Is that okay? Thank you for your nice question. Okay, so any other questions or comments or anything? Or I just want to discuss this point that Srila Rupa Goswami begins his great book by offering his respectful obeisances unto Sri Sanatana Goswami, who is his elder brother and spiritual master. But actually Srila Rupa Goswami is also considered the leader of the six Goswamis, but naturally he defers to his elder brother, Srila Sanatana Goswami. He also considers him his spiritual master. And he prays that Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu may be very pleasing to him. Because the secret of success in spiritual life is actually to please one's spiritual master. Why? Because the spiritual master is actually the representative of Krishna. So if by one's activities one pleases the spiritual master, the Shastras declare in so many places that when the spiritual master is pleased, God is pleased. Actually, this is the process of advancement in spiritual life. And he further prays that by residing in that ocean of nectar, Sri Sanatana Goswami may always feel transcendental pleasure in the service of Radha and Krishna. So not some mundane pleasure, not flattery, not anything, but actually pleasure experiencing transcendental love of Radha and Krishna. This is this wonderful ocean of nectar which we are getting to analyze one little drop from that ocean, unlimited, ever-expanding ocean of nectar. So this is what we're looking at with Nectar of Devotion. This is called, if you look on the front cover, the complete science of Bhakti Yoga. So it's Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu. So the Sindhu is the ocean, and the Bhakti Rasa Amrita, the Bhakti Rasa, that ocean of loving dealings, of devotional service, that just one drop of that is being discussed and described here to give us, try to give us the flavor of the whole ocean. Just like if you take one drop of salty ocean water, then by analyzing its qualities you can begin to get an idea of what the whole ocean is like. So this is Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So this is a very wonderful book. It is just a drop in that, from that ocean of the nectar of devotion, to help us understand what is Krishna. Okay. Ashok Prabhu, would you like to read us the next paragraph, please? Yes, yes, please.
Let us offer our respectful relationship to all the great devotees and various holy teachers, who are compared to sharks in the great ocean of nectar and who do not care for the various rivers of liberation. Impersonalists are very fond of merging into the Supreme, like rivers that come down and merge into the ocean. The ocean can be compared to liberation and the rivers to all the different paths of liberation. The impersonalists are dwelling in the river water, which eventually comes to mix with the ocean. They have no information, however, that within the ocean, as within the river, there are innumerable aquatic living entities. The sharks who dwell in the ocean do not care for the river as they pass, gliding down into it. The devotees eternally live in the ocean of devotional service, and they do not care for the rivers. In other words, those who are pure devotees always remain in the ocean of transcendental loving service to the Lord and have no business with other processes, which are compared to the rivers that only gradually come to the ocean.
So this point Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, that those who are engaged in trying to get liberation from this world, the jnanis, they're trying to speculate and trying to become actually fixed in consciousness of being merged with God. But actually jnanis, when they become fortunate, when they become intelligent, Krishna says, bahunam janmanamante, after many, many such births and deaths. It's a very difficult process. Bahunam jammanam ante jnanavan mam prapadyante. Those who are actually in knowledge, what do? Jnanavan mam prapadyante. They surrender to me. Vasudeva sarvam iti. Knowing that I, Vasudeva, am everything. Samahatma sudolabha. Krishna says that such a great soul is very rare. Actually, so there are many, many jnanis. He says, Manushyanam sahasreshu kaschit yatati siddhaye yatatam api siddhanam kaschit vetimam tatvata. That out of many, many thousands of men, one may endeavor for perfection. And out of all those who've actually achieved perfection, Krishna says, hardly one knows me in truth. So there are many people who will speculate and try to understand what is God. But to actually know Krishna is not an ordinary thing. But the jnanis, they are, and the impersonalists, they are of the impression they are absorbed simply in these rivers which gradually make their way to the ocean, with the view to simply merging with that ocean. But they have no knowledge of the aquatics living and diving and swimming and enjoying the wonderful nature, as separate living entities within that ocean of life. in fact. They simply want to give up their eternal existence, but they have no knowledge of all the living entities who are living within, but not at all merged with that ocean. But they're experiencing the transcendental, blissful nature of that ocean of devotional service. So for the jnanis, this is incomprehensible, because all they can think about is like a drop in the ocean, and just a drop merging and giving up their identity. They've got no understanding. So Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is presented in this light. But the idea here is that the sharks, the great aquatics, the acharyas, the great holy teachers, the acharya means one who teaches by his own example. Not just giving spoken examples, but living example. This is acharya. They are like the great sharks living within that ocean. What does a great shark care for living in some paltry river when he can swim around in the whole ocean? You know, what's the use of some two-bit river of liberation? It's useless, actually. So liberation, as we'll see, is described as something very insignificant. Are simply an insignificant byproduct of devotional service. And when liberation is offered to a devotee, he's actually not interested. He actually only wants to take devotional service. What use is, especially the impersonal liberation, if you give up your existence as an individual, how you will serve Krishna? This is, for the Vaishnava, for the pure devotee, this is worse than hell, to not have a chance to serve Krishna. And even the other types of liberation, they may be accepted because there is some opportunity to have some role where one can render service to Krishna. For example, the other four types of liberation. Sayujya means merging one's existence with the Supreme Lord. But that is actually a will-o'-the-wisp. It's not a permanent situation. And the Bhagavatam also declares that ultimately they again fall down, patantiyada, again they fall down, because avishuddha buddhayo, their intelligence is not perfectly clarified, it's not filtered properly, it's not clear intelligence. They're still thinking that they're no longer individual living beings, and that they're not meant for loving service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So because avishuddha buddhayo, because their buddhi, their intelligence is not clear, is not purified, again, patantiyada, yushmadangraya. Again, they come back down because of material desires, impure, unpurified material desires. They fall down from that liberated state. So it's not a permanent liberation. But the other four types of liberation, which are, who knows any of the other four types of liberation? That's one, but there are five types. One is to... Yes, to have similar bodily features like the Lord. That's sarupya. Yes, sarupya mukti. Yes.
Are you on the same planet as Lord Krishna?
Yes, salokya, to live on the same planet as the Supreme Lord. That's a pretty good place. You're living on the same planet as the Supreme Lord. Maybe you get to serve him one day. Sarupya, have bodily features like Krishna. This is actually a symptom of someone who's in, who's close to Krishna. And what else? Sarupya, so bodily form like that of the Supreme Lord. Uddhava, he's a wonderful example of someone. When he came to Vrindavan, he looked so much like Krishna, he dressed like Krishna, because he only used to wear the garments that Krishna had finished with. And he actually looked just like Krishna. At first they thought, this is Krishna. No, he's not Krishna. He's very beautiful. And in fact the gopis were saying, who is the fortunate woman who is married to this wonderfully handsome young man? But they were surprised to see the bodily form of Uddhava. So, and sarupya, salokya, to live on the same planet as Krishna, as the Supreme Lord. And there are two others also. Jayananda Prabhu is being very intelligent. He's looking through the index and trying to suss the part where this is described. So, okay. There's one, shasti, which means to have the same opulences as the Supreme Lord. One can have the same opulences as Krishna. This is another type of liberation from this world, where you can have all wealth, beauty, fame, strength, knowledge, and renunciation like that. And there's also samipya, which is to be a personal associate of the Supreme Lord. So these may sometimes be accepted by the pure devotee if there's some nice opportunity for rendering loving service, but they're actually not very interesting, because the devotee, the pure devotee, doesn't even care to get out of the material world. The pure devotee doesn't even care to get out of the world of birth and death, so long as he can be engaged in the loving service of Krishna. He doesn't care whether he's serving Krishna in hell or heaven. He doesn't care where he is or in the material world, so long as he has the chance for loving devotional service to Krishna. This is the standard of pure devotional service. Everything else is insignificant. So therefore we can begin to get an idea what is the standard of happiness available from pure devotional service to Krishna that exceeds the happiness of all the different five kinds of liberation and makes them all appear completely paltry and insignificant. That they, yeah, who cares for that? I don't want it like that. Any other questions, comments? Mukesh Guru. No, good, good. I know, your question's always good.
The difference between Buddhist Nirvana, impersonalism, and let's say Jainism.
Buddhism, the idea is, it's a nihilistic process. It's a process of killing yourself, extinguishing your individual existence and merging with the void, with nirvana. This is, in a nutshell, the Buddhist process. Because the idea is that life, according to the Buddhist process, life itself is so painful. It means suffering. And therefore, you merge all your different elements of your existence with the whole and realize that actually it's all void. Nothing really exists. This is Buddhism. Okay? You have to do some pretty serious scrambling of the brain to try to get into that mode. Anyway, but Jainism, I'm not sure what the ultimate goal of Jainism is, but it's an offshoot of Hinduism that was started, you know, some years back. It's by no means part of the original Vedic text. It's somebody else's, you know, it's another religion which has started up with a view to trying not to cause pain to other living entities, because they wear these masks, at least the proper Jains, they wear these masks so they don't kill, they hope, living entities when they breathe.
They're very, you're going to get a spine freeze, you wear one of those masks.
Yeah. Well, people, they're probably a bit more serious than some of the modern day Jains. But the principle is that the idea is that whenever you even drink a drop of water, you're killing so many thousands of living entities. So what is the question of not causing violence? The principle is like Buddha's principle, which is of non-violence, ahimsa. That's actually Buddhism. Practicing ahimsa, non-violence. But nowadays it's become so wishy-washy that in America it's considered the number one religion, because as far as they're concerned, Buddhism means you can do anything you like. That's how things become so contaminated and degraded and ridiculous in the course of time. They just become a farce in the course of time in the material world. So Jainism, you'll have to ask a Jain, and if you can find a Jain who can really give you a good answer what the ultimate goal of Jainism, that would be interesting to hear, because I'm not sure what it is.
But not necessarily just Jainism, there's all the Mayavadi philosophies going on. But isn't it true to say that with Buddhism, they're not having any form of deities or anything involved with that? They're not saying, you know, whilst in the other Mayavadi's spectrum, they are using deities to a certain extent, but then I believe once they achieve their ultimate goal, they...
Yes.
Because I think Prabhupada, there was once where he was giving this example to his disciple, saying, well, give me a hand over a little pond, a little puddle, and he sort of gave his hand, you know, to cross it, and then as he crossed it, he let go.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using this forms and to pass over, but then we don't want anything to do with it.
Yes, they're using it as a means to an end to try to become God.
Which is worse, actually, because
yes.
The Buddhism, they're not being offensive in that way. They're saying from the beginning, we don't believe in the formula. They're not on the personality of the Lord. They're not trying to extinguish it.
Just their own personality.
Yes.
They cannot accept that there is any personality. They say that
yes.
everything is ultimately
surely
void.
The other one is more offensive because...
Yes. The Mayavadis are considered Pashandis, actually offenders to the Lord, because they accept the position of the body of Vishnu or Narayan, and they consider themselves on the same level as Narayan. Therefore we see that the Mayavadi sannyasis, they address each other, Om Namo Narayan. You are also Narayan. I'm Narayan. We're all Narayan. And so in that way they try to put themselves on the same level as the Supreme Lord. And in this way they become great offenders. And therefore the goal that they want to achieve to become merged with Brahman is the same reward as the demons are given when they're killed by Krishna. They're on the same level as the demons, actually, because they're against the authority of the personality of Godhead. So yes, they are more offensive.
You see, the classic symptoms of these different groups appearing all over the world is the first thing they do is throw away the deity of the Radha and Krishna. So many people used to keep maybe Bal Krishna, Radha Krishna, then they go and attend these lectures and meditation groups and yoga. They start off with general, you know, carrot and things like that. This will offer you this, better this and better that. And then what they do is coming back from their group sessions and they throw away the deities of Radha and Krishna and Bal Gopal, whatever they were, their ancestors were doing. They chuck all that in the rubbish tin and then they start the process becoming God. This is a classic symptom of what's happening in different towns and cities all over the world, you see. I've seen so many cases like that.
Really? Yeah, they're very unfortunate that they... Because Krishna's instruction in Bhagavad Gita is very clearly that you meditate on my transcendental form. You always think of me. You engage your mind always in thinking of me. So they want to throw away this form of Krishna and have done with it.
Some groups focus on some white light, some different... Sometimes it's just physical... breathing processes, and they say, Radha Krishna, you don't need them anymore.
Yeah. So this is basically the whole world is filled with impersonalism and voidism.
I know this friend. In Bombay, both the brothers were worshipping Bal Gopal 2 hours, 3 hours daily in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Then they went to see some yoga group and this group and that group, and they threw literally Bal Gopal, and they actually gave it to somebody else. He doesn't want it anymore.
Yeah. So this is the thing.
Krishna, they have a problem with.
Krishna rewards everyone accordingly. He explains in Bhagavad Gita that yeyetam amprapadyante tam stataiva bhajamyaham. Each as they surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. So if we want to forget all about Krishna, Krishna gives us the opportunity to enter into the darkest region of ignorance. And in fact, in the Sri Upanishad mantra, we find that it is described that those who are engaged in the culture of knowledge, this is very good, but those who are engaged in the study of ignorance is an appalling situation, but worse still are those who are engaged in the so-called culture of knowledge. And in fact, very interesting book, Sri Upanishad. Anyone got a copy of it here? Actually, I think I've got a copy on my phone somewhere. I heard a phone go beep, beep, beep somewhere. But I've got a copy on here. Some very interesting mantras which are very powerful to explain in this regard, because generally the Upanishads tend to focus on the impersonal feature of the Lord. But in fact, the Shriyas Upanishad is a very special Upanishad, because that particularly reveals the personality of Godhead. And there are some very wonderful situations in this regard to help us understand it. I just find this for you because the very, very powerful verses. Let's have a look. Here we go. Yeah. Those who engage in the culture of nescient or ignorant activities shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. And here are some other interesting ones, which the Shriyas Upanishad also explains. Those who are engaged in the worship of the demigods enter into the darkest region of ignorance, and still more so to the worshippers of the impersonal absolute. Very powerful statements, actually, in the Shriyas Upanishad. Why the worshippers of the demigods go into the darkest region of ignorance? Because the darkest region of ignorance means to be in a situation where you forget about the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And if you're going off into a world where you simply are trying to enjoy your senses in wonderful facilities to the hilt, then you're in the darkest ignorance. Because you're so much absorbed in trying to enjoy the senses of the body that how can you understand about that Krishna is the enjoyer? And here it's said that those who are engaged in the worship of the demigods enter into the darkest region of ignorance, and still more so do the worshippers of the impersonal absolute. Why? Because they're actually even deeper in ignorance, because they're thinking, now I've become God. This is actually the situation. So these literatures are presented to help us understand everything properly in perspective. That's why the Vedic literatures are there. And that's why Srila Rupa Goswami and Srila Sanatan Goswami are presenting this Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu to help us understand it very carefully. So here we see that, as Ashok Prabhu was reading, in other words, those who are pure devotees always, this is the top of page XX, in other words, those who are pure devotees always remain in the ocean of transcendental loving service to the Lord and have no business with the other processes, which are compared to the rivers that only gradually come to the ocean. Bahunam jammana mante jnana bhamman prapadyante. That after many, many births and deaths, one who is actually in knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing that I, Vasudev, am everything. Such a great soul is very rare. Okay, so unless anybody has got any other questions or comments? You have a question, Rasika? Or any comment? Okay. So we're just diving into this wonderfully powerful book, but you can see that Prabhupada, he actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 let's see, 7, 8, 9, 10 Prabhupada gave about 12 lectures just on this introduction to the next year of devotion, because there's so much important subject matter. And I'm talking long lectures, you know, like a couple of hours sometimes, 2 hours. You know, very powerful, because there's so much wealth of information which is helpful for us to try to capture and understand, so that we can see what is this wonderful book that we're trying to get into studying. It's not abstract, it's not imagination. They're factually extraordinarily powerful works. to give us direct contact with Krishna. And as we shall see from studying this book, Prabhupada explains that those who read this book actually associate with Srila Rupa Goswami. Actually, we get the association of this great Acharya, Nectar of Rupa Goswami, just by reading this book. And by trying to follow the instructions given in this book, we serve his lotus feet. That is the fact. So these are very powerful books. And because this is also given by Prabhupada, the same is completely true of Srila Prabhupada. By reading this book, we actually associate with Srila Prabhupada because this is his mood. He is representing the same topic of the nectar of devotion. And by trying to apply the instructions, we serve Srila Prabhupada's lotus feet very, very nicely. So thank you all very much for this. Let's pause here and we have a little kirtan and then a little prasadam. How about that?
It's fine.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Rupa Goswami Prabhupada ki jai. Nitai Gaura Premanandi Hari Bol. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthana Bhutaraya Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamaya. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gaura Vani Pachaya. Nivasesha Sunyavaya Vastitya Vashitaya.
Hare Krishna.
What a wonderful book.